Thanks, Will, for that nice introduction. I'm very happy to be here. Today, I am going to tell you about some of our recent work in trying to understand bacterial chemotaxis. I like to put this in a bigger context, as you said, Will said, that you know what we're really trying to do is trying to understand biological behavior from molecules. So this behavior comes about because the interaction of different biomolecules. So therefore the title from molecules to behavior, and in specifically I will tell about the behavior called the chemotaxis. That's the way bacteria as a single cell organism can track gradient of attractant like food and other stimulus, and go moving away from high concentration of repellent or toxin. So that's the ability for the cell to adjust its movement towards a favorable condition and away from a toxic condition. That's the behavior. And I will tell you that it carries out this behavior by having two very basic functions carried out at the molecular level. One is that it actually was able to carry a very simple memory of its past. And also it can do a very simple calculation of subtraction. By using these two operations, the cell can actually do this wonderful and necessary function of have this wonderful behavior of chemotaxis. All of this theoretical work, I'm a theorist, are inspired by experiments over the years from Howard Berg's lab, where you came from for his PhD. And in particular, the work done by Victor Sojic and Tom Shimizu, two postdocs who did the most recent experimental work. And the work was also carried out at IBM, earlier work done by Bernardo Mello, a postdoc, and now he's back in Brazil, Gang Hui Lan, who's a current postdoc, and a couple of students from around the world. Okay. So, as I talked about molecules, so in biology, the building block of biological system are these molecules. So you probably know about DNA being the genetic, coding the genetic information, and protein, which is really carry out the day-to-day, the actual work. And what we're trying to understand here is what biological network does. You know, most biological functions are carried out by interactions between different biomolecules, as illustrated here by these blocks, which each one represent one particular type of protein or DNA, and the links in between them, which is basically interaction between them. So this biological network gave rise to biological behaviors. And underneath here, I wrote down the sort of the biology jargon for these. So people in computational biology, in studying DNA, a lot of them are called bioinformaticians. Bioinformatic is the subject. And here, by looking at the protein structure, a lot of people in computational biology works on protein folding. And here, this is a new branch of biology. It's called systems biology. What it is, in my interpretation, is basically how do biomolecules interact to give rise to biological behaviors, right? So that's, and since this is a physics audience, I would say that this is, in analogy, is like elementary particle physics. You try to identify the building blocks, right? And this is really like the condensed matter physics. You try to understand how interaction between these elementary particle give rise to behavior, a piece of material. Okay. Of course, biological systems are much more complex for the following reasons. There are many types of molecules that's involved in this network, as I just showed you, and the interaction are heterogeneous, meaning that different type of molecule interact with different types of rates. Also, the type of interaction are not fully identified. There are many missing elements and many missing links in this interaction in this network, right? And many, of course, quantitatively, a lot of these kinetic constants are just simply unknown, So what do we do in terms of and try to do systems biology? What do we really need, again, making an analogy to physics, what we really need is a very simple system that we can actually sink our teeth into and try to understand is a hydrogen atom in systems biology, right? So we want a simple system, but yet distribute have a very interesting behavior. And that's where we come in to look at the very simple organism like E. coli, a simple single-celled organism, and a simple behavior called chemotaxis. And it's a general behavior in a very simple model system, right? And by doing that, we actually can look at signal transduction and sensory system in biology in general. And this is probably our best chance to quantitatively understand a complex biological system now. And in doing so, we can actually try to decipher general principle, if they are, in understanding complex biological systems, such as, you know, very interesting and unique biological behavior like adaptation. And we understand how the signal being processed, understand the robustness of the biological system, the effect of noise, and so on and so forth. These are very general questions, not limited to E. coli chemotaxis, but by studying chemotaxis, we can address these questions and maybe can shed light to more study more complex systems. So here is the E. coli cell. It's about 2 micron long, right? It's a rod shaped, about the diameter is about 1 micron, and has a lot of molecules inside the cell, inside the membrane, right? Including molecules, including proteins that sit right on the membrane. These are very important ones. These are receptors. These are ones that bridge the outside world to inside world. So these are the sensors, right? It senses the outside world, and inside all these molecules are doing is processing this information and decide what to do, right? And these are little things, the flagella, this longish things, are the things that propel the cell going forward. Okay, so today we're going to talk about the equivalence of the nose, how that sense outside world, the brain, how does it process it, and I will not have time to talk about how that actually move. But we will talk about a little bit about maybe the interaction between these two. So we'll talk about basically these three elements and how cell receive the signal from outside, how does it process the signal, and how does it react to it. So that's... So in 1972, Howard Berg and Brown developed a tracking microscope, the first tracking microscope that's able to track a motile E. coli. What they find is quite interesting. What they found is that the cell moves. Not only it moves rather in a rather interesting fashion. It has two modes of motion. Either it runs forward in a straight, more almost straight line, or it tumbles. So when it tumbles, the flagella, each cell has from 4 to 6 flagella, will fly apart, doesn't form the coherent bundle, and as a result, the cell jiggles around locally and changes its orientation. So if you put a gradient, so here's more favorable condition here, what they saw is that it's a random walk of the E. coli cell. Namely, it is pretty random locally, but there's a net bias towards the higher concentration of attractant. So here is a movie of how it moves. You may not see the random bias random walk, but this is how it moves around. And here's the cell is like very small. The flagella is much longer than the cell body length, right? So let me show it again. Oops. It moves around and suddenly it changes direction. So that's what I was talking about. It's two modes of motion, run and tumble. So by this two simple motion, it was able to seek higher concentration of attractant, the region. So how does it do that? Basically, it does that by switching between tumble and run, by comparing. So when you run in a straight line, you have to decide when will you turn next time, right? When we will turn. And the probability of turning depends on a simple calculation. Basically, if my current situation, that's phenomenology, if my current situation is better than my past environment, I will keep the running motion longer, a little bit longer. Then if I'm moving away from favorable condition, my condition has deteriorated, it's deteriorating, then I will make that run happen faster, a tumble happens faster. So that way introduces a bias towards the higher concentration of attractor. Yes? Yes. Good eye. I mean, okay, so I said in a straight line. That's a lie. It's never straight. But that, it curls a little bit because of what's called rotational diffusion. These are really random noise from the media. The Brownian motion from the liquid water is swimming by. It actually bias, it actually drift the thing around randomly.
It's never relationship.
No. That's random for it. But the part that tumbles will totally change the direction abruptly. But that's two different kinds of noise happening at two different time scale. All right, so that's the phenomenology. That's the chemotaxis behavior, okay? As I said, the way people think it does that is by what people call a temporal comparison or temporal gradient sensing. The cell, ideally, if I'm a big enough cell, the way I can calculate or determine a spatial gradient would be that I calculate the concentration of this chemical at the front and the back, and I do a spatial subtraction, and I decide which direction is better, right? That would be the ideal situation. But unfortunately, E. coli is too small to do that. The cell is not long enough for it to calculate spatial gradient directly, but it developed this temporal sensing. Namely, it moves around and senses the concentration temporally. And by also keeping a memory of its recent past, it can calculate derivative in time. And since it's also moving, the calculation of derivative in time translates into a derivative in space. Therefore, that's how it calculates the spatial gradient. Now here are the two questions. How does cell keep a memory of its past history, where it has been? And how does it carry out the calculation of subtraction, right? So basically, how is the memory and computation performed by the molecule inside the cell? So that's the subject of this talk, is that, you know, it has these two capabilities, and how does it come about at a molecular level? Now, over the years, since the 70s and even early on to this day, a lot of biochemical work, genetic work has been carried out on this model system, and people have identified these boxes. Remember I told you these boxes are proteins, and these are the elements of this network that carry out, these are molecules that carry out this work. And in particular, you have this, what biochemists call or biologists call pathway diagram. It's an E. coli chemotaxis pathway, but it's a molecular signal processing machine, and each one of them is the element in this machine. For example, there's two double bar. The double bar here represent the membrane, and the guys sitting on the double bar are the sensors, are the receptors. Okay, so this is outside world. Outside world will interact with the sensor, with the receptor, by binding to it, by chemical binding. And after binding, something else happened at the cytoplasmic end, at the inside the cell. And that signal is, in terms of a phosphorylation of this protein, passed on to this little guy called KY. It's another protein which will basically carry the signal from the receptor and diffuse to the other end or somewhere else on the membrane where the motor sits. Tell the motor that you should tumble now or you should, you know, keep going. Okay, so that's sort of the linear passage of the signal from outside through the membrane-bound receptor to the response regulator KY to the motor. Okay, now what about these two guys? Well, KR and KB are the two enzymes that over longer time modulate these receptors so that it adapts. Now, if you think about it a little bit, that this is a sensory system for E. coli. It senses the outside environment. Just like we have five senses, we have hearing, eyesight, and so on. What is the characteristic of a sensory system? Well, one of it is that you can sense changes, right? Sense change means that you have to adapt to your old environment in order to adapt to respond to a new environment. For example, if you go to a very bright room from a very dark environment, what happens first is that you cannot recognize anything, any little changes in the room, because you all get saturated. Your photoreceptor gets saturated. But after a while, you adapt to the environment, and you can then detect little changes of contrast or light. So adaptation is essential for sensory system, biological sensory system. And in E. coli, there's no exception. But these are carried out by these two enzymes, KR and KB. These are molecules, proteins, that go in and modify these sensors, desensitize it, basically, according to the outside environment, by covalently modify certain residues on this protein. Now, as I told you, that the idea is to work out how these elements fit together and give rise to this behavior. So therefore, you can break them into several parts. You have signal transduction, sensing of the signal, amplifying the signal, adaptation, and so on. And then the signal has to interact with the motor by switching it. And the motor, after they get the signal, has to drive the load to push the body forward. We work on all these parts, but today I'm going to tell you mostly about the signal transduction part. How does it sense it? How does it process it? And how does it adapt to this external stimulus over longer time? The key molecules for the, obviously, is this receptor, this membrane-bound receptor, and the KR and the KB are the two enzymes that modify it over longer time, and the kinase that binds at the end of this receptor that eventually sort of receive the signal and pass it on to the response regulator, right? So these are the most important protein elements in this pathway. We'll see that again later in the talk. Now, let's go back a little bit, say, okay, so that's all fine, Yuhai, what are you doing here, right? What I'm doing here. So as a physicist, what are we doing here? As a physicist, give you a piece of material, I will try to ask you to understand how does it work, what is the property, what are you going to do? So we'll just kick it, we'll just perturb it and see what happened to it. So basically, I think it's the same approach we're going to take to E. coli, a cell, or any other biological system. You kick it, you give it a perturbation, you perturb it by either chemically, give it a ligand, or you force it, you push it. You zap it with pH, you heat up, right? You change temperature, and you look at the response. The response could be the protein concentration change, could the mRNA level change, could be also behavior, as we talked about chemotaxis behavior. And why is modeling, as a theorist, why does modeling help? Well, modeling would help if you perturb it, either by external means. Or in biological system, you have another tool, which is internal perturbation. You actually go in and you mess around with this machinery inside and see what happened, right? Internal, you have mutation. And you have to observe the response. The modeling comes in to bridge these two, to understand you have input, output, what goes in the middle, okay? So I justify my existence. Now let's see what data we can tackle. Now, for us to be of any use, we have to have quantitative data, right? So it only started to be available about seven, 8 years ago, again, pioneered in the Howard Berg's lab. What happened is that there they developed a method where they can probe the cell in vivo without killing it, right? Biochemistry has existed for a very long time for this system, but in vivo probing the cell inside as it's still alive and behaving was first developed less than 10 years ago, by using fluorescent resonant energy transfer. Basically, depending on the transfer of the light transfer between two different tagged molecules, you can decide the concentration of one of them. That's the basic idea. But here are the kind of experiment you do. You give it an input, which basically is for the outside, you give it a step function of the concentration of the ligand or the chemical that it's still trying to sense. This is the perturbation, right? A step function perturbation. And then you measure inside what happened. what happens to the protein concentration, right? For example, or the phosphorylation level of this protein. And this is the output. Output goes, have a response, but eventually, as you see, even though the input is still up here, it recovers, right? As you remove the stimulus, the thing goes the opposite way before it comes back again, okay? So these are the kind of input-output measurement people can do. And as I told you, so you can do this for different background and different mutant, right? Different mutant means that you actually go in and you knock out certain genes, you knock out certain enzymes, so you can actually do the input-output measurement also for the mutants. So you have a whole set of data, for example, for for wild-type cell, meaning that you haven't messed around with it, in different background, different mutants, a different methylation level in different mutants, different ratio of certain protein level, and so on and so forth. You have tons of data generated by this new evolutionary technology from Berg's lab, and that's where we come in. And what they find is something quite interesting. Now, people know that for qualitatively for a while, but this is the first time quantitatively it was pointed out that this box actually does a lot of interesting things. It keeps a high sensitivity for a very wide dynamic range. Namely, the signal is amplified. The signal, if you add a little bit here, you look at the response. You add a little bit more, you look at the response. The response amplification means that how much do you have increased your input. If you increase 1% here, how many percent you increase here? And that's called the gain of the system. The gain of the system is around 40. It's a number, right? We like numbers. And not only it's very large, this is considered to be pretty large in biological system, it happens in a wide range of background, meaning that if you change the background concentration up and down by four orders of magnitude or more, you would not affect this high gain. The high gain exists in a very, very wide range of background. So here are the questions. How does it come about? These are the observations, right? So let's now, from this point on, we're going to introduce some modeling. Yes? Oh. This one? No, no, no. You basically you shine light and you shine light and you measure the how much is in the yellow channel, right? How much is transferred to here? So basically, this is more technical than probably the rest of the audience. Is that you want to measure the phosphorylated part of a KY. So you cannot measure phosphorylation level very easily. But fortunately, you have a phosphatase, KZ. So you label the KY and the phosphatase because the phosphatase only binds with the phosphorylated KY. So the this red pair tells you how much of KY there is in the cell.
So basically, you're saying there's an optical signature of the chemical activity in the cell.
Yes.
So in other words, the input is actually a chemical, right?
The input is the outside of the cell. You add something, and it binds with the receptor and triggers this downstream thing, and you measure. That's the output. That's the output of the pathway. It's not the output of the motion, which goes through the motor. So we want to dissect the thing into different parts to study. And this is the technique that is sort of successfully, for the first time, dissected it at the intracellular level. Okay, energy. So how do we study a system? We first study its steady state energetics, right, before we go to dynamics. So we have first identified the states. What are the states? Well, we have the receptor, and the easiest way, and the most simplest way to look at it is that it can have basically two states. Either it's active or inactive. But I would say, well, they really have four states because you can have either be bound with the ligand, the chemical, or unbound, right? So you have two binary variables describing this receptor. So kinase activity can be 0 and 1. Ligand binding can be 0 and 1. So you have these four states. And all I'm saying is that there are this chemical equilibrium between the four states depending on the concentration of the ligand and the intrinsic property of the receptor itself. In other words, if we look at just activity, it can be either A equals 0, A equals 1, the double well potential, it can be either here and here. What we're changing is the relative energy between the two states. Modulated, these are modulated by the concentration L outside world by binding energy. People recognize this is sort of like the chemical potential binding energy. And another internal energy term, which basically says, even in the absence of this term, no concentration, you still have a baseline activity, which is modulated by, controlled by some intrinsic property. That intrinsic property turns out to depend on the methylation level. Remember, the receptor can have this methylation either on and off. So there's another internal parameter called M, characterized methylation level. So basically, the energy have two terms. One coming from internal state, one coming from the outside state. If you wish, this is the magnetic field for the spin, okay, as a spin up and spin down state. And this is the internal field, determined if in the absence of the external field, which state it would prefer. All right, so that's, we actually can calculate this, can measure this first term. It's not easily calculatable from first principle. So we can actually, but we can measure it. And indeed, Shimizu et al. In 2006 measured the response curve for different levels of M. Okay, so basically he measured for different M what is this curve. And from this curve, he actually can calculate the F of M, the energy due to this internal variable M. And it finds that this internal energy depends almost linearly depending on the methylation level. So basically, keep that in mind. So this internal energy is determined almost linearly by the internal variable M, whereas the other variable almost go logarithmically. Okay? So we'll come back to that later. Okay, so we have described one single receptor. You may have not noticed before, but I in the beginning I said there are 20,000 of these receptors on the membrane. Not only they are 20,000, they actually form clusters as measured before in 93, where they labeled it and they find they all cluster together. And they clustered in later higher resolution cryo-EM images show that these guys, these receptors, actually form very tight clusters to the extent that they talk to each other. How do we model that? We have to model that, right? So how do we model that? So we have the good old ISI model, right? So they interact with each other, there's a cooperativity. Basically it says that each dot corresponds to one receptor that can live in the four states, right? Now, between the neighbor, you can introduce a coupling term. Basically it says if I am up, I'm active, you are more likely to be active. This is a ferromagnetic coupling, which will introduce cooperativity, which will introduce amplification of signal, namely gain. So that's how you introduce that. You can actually have more simpler model to do that, but that the basic idea is that you introduce cooperativity through the clustering, interaction between neighbors. Now you have a very respectable Ising-like Hamiltonian, right? So this is a physics audience, you should recognize the A is either 0 and 1, correspond to spin up and spin down. So therefore, here is basically a local magnetic field. On each little spin, you have a local magnetic. Why is it local? Because you have a local field that determines on its intrinsic property, which is not global, right? The concentration it's filling is global, but the local property may be local. And you have a coupling term, and you have a chemical potential term controlling the occupancy and vacancy of the receptor with respect to the ligand. Right, so you have a more complex, it's analogous to Ising model, but it's basically Ising version of the receptor cluster model. So how does it work? Does it work? And we claim it does. So if you first look at its mutant, so these are the mutant where the internal state, M, is fixed. So by genetic method, you actually can fix M either be 0, 1, 2, or 3, or 4. There are these five different states. So Howard Berg and company has engineered this receptor to be fixed in 0, 1, or 2, or 3, or 4 Or also for the other type of receptor, you can also do the same trick, and they can put them together as a mixed cluster and measure the input and output. So we can have a mixed IZ model, and the lines are the result from the mixed IZ model, and the symbols are the result from the experiment. Okay, so we have to fix the parameter by fitting to these different symbols, but we use one universal set of parameters. So this is one universal set of parameters that fits six different mutants simultaneously. There's no overfitting here. If you take away one, use them as a test, you'll get the same thing as predicted. So it works for the wild, for the mutant. What about wild type? For the wild type cell, the M is not fixed. Methylation is not fixed. What happened there is that for the wild type cell, what is fixed though is that the system adapts perfectly. Adaptation happens in wild type cell because you have these two enzymes, KR and KB. So you can also still use the same similar model. I mean, here we have used the simplified version of the cooperativity model called the Monod, Wyman, and Chang-Ju model to calculate the activity, but by requiring that the system always goes to this adapted activity A0 independent of its background. And then we feed back into this model, and again, the results, the lines are the theory, and the dots are the experiment. Okay, and again, here is more impressive because you really only have one, two, three parameters, and these are all have meaning. From fitting the experimental data, we actually know how big, what is the correlation length of this IZ model. It's namely in an area that contains 20 dimers. 20 individual spins are highly correlated in this very large cluster. Okay, that's the number N tells you. Looking in a different way, if you look at this response, this is a response curve. Now, this is the wild-type cell. It adapts, remember, right? So as you increase the background, what happens is that the response curve actually shifted. So these different curves correspond to the response curve when you first incubate the system in a particular background concentration of this ligand, and then you measure the input-output. As you see, as the outside background concentration increases, this response curve shifted, right? Well, and these hollow dots correspond to the adapted states, and the adapted state all seem to sit in the middle range of this response curve. And why is that? Well, that's where you want to be. What is special about this middle point? The middle point is where the steepest response is. Little bit of change around here, we induce very large change here, and that's part of the gain. Now, as a physicist, you won't be surprised that you have a very sharp response curve. That's just, you know, you have a large correlation length. I mean, you even can push to infinite response sensitivity because that's just the critical phenomena, right? Near the critical point, your response is infinite. So that, you know, but you know, the price to pay for very high sensitivity is that the range of that high sensitivity is extremely narrow, right? You have to tune your parameter to that critical point in order to benefit from the sharpness of this response curve, but not in living cell. What living cell have found is that it can tune itself so that I shift my response curve to always sit near its very sensitive or near critical point, right? So in other words, as I posted before at the very beginning, the puzzle is that the mechanism for sustained high gain is really self-tuned near critical behavior. This is the smart IZ model. Basically, it's trying to tune its internal field to always cancel out the outside field so that it always sits in the middle of this curve where it has the highest sensitivity. So this is actually the smart IZ model, right? So the internal dynamic is such that it self-tuned itself to near the critical point. So it reminded me of the surfer. If you really think about, you look sideways, the surfer really, you cannot always sit on the top or the bottom. You really have to sit, you have to keep yourself in that very sweet spot in order to be swept, go forward by the wave. E. coli is really surfing, this wave, of course, is not the real wave. It's in the methylation space. You have to serve the methylation wave so that you always sit near the best place where it's most sensitive for the swimming cell. Okay? So that's the end of the energetics of the scene. So we have come up with a very reasonable energetic model for the four states and the interaction between the neighboring receptors. Explain a lot of data. So what about dynamics? So the best way to probe dynamics, of course, is to probe it with time varying signal, right? So up to this point, I've told you about the step function, response to the step function, right? But any living cell in their whole life probably have never seen a step function, right? So the cell is trying to tell you that it is the kinetics, blah, blah, right? So if you know what I mean. So this is the kind of signal you really want to understand how it responds to. Again, go back. So let's move back a little bit. How do we model that? We model that, again, going back to this very important molecule, the receptor. This is the membrane. Here is the ligand binding part. This is the part that binds with outside signal. This is the part, the action part. This is the kinase activity part, which is on and off. Here is the key part for the dynamics. This is the part that itself tuning itself according to its outside world. And this happens in a slower time step. And that slower time step is exactly how the system keeps a memory. Memory is nothing but a longer a recording that doesn't fade away in a longer period of time than the immediate response, right? So we use a liberal way of interpreting that. And that basically the E. coli has these digits. This residue can be either modified or unmodified. There are four of them on each one. So this is really like an abacus, right? So I've seen good life, so I put one abacus up, and that life has turning little worse, you take one off. And so it's sort of a cumulative way of understanding in the recent past, how was your life, right? And then you compare that with this, the immediate response, or immediate environment to determine whether your life has getting better or worse. So now we can model that by looking at the variable M, which is basically the memory, A, the output, and the input, which is the ligand concentration, and in a very simple network like this. So this is a coarse-grained dynamical model for chemotaxis. This is the dynamical model, okay? So we first assume cross-equilibrium. All the energetics goes in here, we talked about before in the first part of the talk. And dynamics have basically DMDT, the methylation, the internal state dynamics, have to depend on A, M, and L. That's all the variable there is, right? But the form is very special, we claim. Here's the key hypothesis. That perfect adaptation, the system over a long time, always goes to, independent of outside world, always go to a constant, means that the dependence on the M and L has to be very weak. Why? In steady state, you set this equation equal 0. If this doesn't depend on M or L, then F of A equals 0 will just go to A equals A0, a constant that's independent of L, the outside world. Right? Very simple. And the form, as I said, of the delta E, the energy, is coming from the energetics. And F is the key dynamical function. We don't know its form, but we know it only has dependence on A. And it could be like this or this. This is A0. So that's the function we're trying to understand and trying to detect. Not going into molecular detail, but by looking at the response to time-dependent signals. I promised you I had to show this slide, but here it is. So let's step back again, one more step, just to have fun. How does the system remember the outside world? It works like a scale. It wants to keep this balance. Basically, it doesn't know what the outside world is, but it has a scale that it likes to keep balanced. So at time equals 0, you add on the stimulus. You have signal coming in and tilted the balance. If you tilt the balance, balance is off. The cell says, the balance is off. Let me add my internal variable. Let me start to increase my internal variable. Until it gets balanced. And at the point it's balanced, I know this is equal to that. This is a measure of that, right? My internal variable at this point is a measure of my outside world. That's how you design a measure. Fair enough? And as I said before, the dependence on this M is linear. It designs a linear scale inside. But the dependence on the outside world to the energy is logarithmic. It's basically entropic, right? Entropic contribution, a binding energy. Now, the balance of that implies that the M, the internal measure, is not measuring the concentration itself. The measuring is log, logarithmic measurement. I was telling this to Will in the lunchtime, is that this is how we design currency, right? So you want to pay bill. The bill can be ranging from $1 to $1,000, $10,000. How do you define your bill? You define your bill by $1, $2, $3, all the way up. Terrible design. How you define it? You design it by doing the log scale. So at least in Chinese currency, I was in China giving this talk last summer. I look at the currency, Canadian probably too. You have a $1, two, the rank three is five. Rank four is 10. Rank five is, again, repeat this. This is a rank, and this is log scale. You see the linear scale? So biology has beat us by billions of years by designing this internal currency to measure outside world. Okay, so how do you do that? How do you actually figure out what this function is, f of a, the mystery function? Well, you do that by giving the cell not a step function, but something dependent on time, something that relates to time scale, have a time scale to it. And here I mentioned some forgotten experiment that recently has come up repeatedly in different contexts. Namely, you can give the cell a time-dependent signal as a ramp, for example. And in particular, in this case, because it's sensing the log, you want to give it a log exponential signal, right? Exponentially increasing signal. So exponential ramp, exponentiated sine wave. So you also, as a systems engineer, if you give you a black box, what do you want to do? You want to shake it a different frequency. You want to do using a different the amplitude to shake it. You want to see what happened in frequency space as well, right? So these are the two time-dependent signal you want to give the cell. And indeed, it was done in the 80s by the Howard Briggs lab. Really, real pioneer. I mean, this is, and after 20 years, people start to do this again and think it's a big deal, nature, science, cells, whatever. But this was done before. So what is our theory going to predict if you subject the cell to a exponential ramp of rate r, e to the log of l equals r of t? Well, through this formalism, this is a little hard to read, I understand. Basically, you want to balance this term with this term, and this term goes exponential. Have to take the log, it becomes linear in t. So basically, you want m to increase linearly with t to balance it, right? So m will increase linearly with t to balance exponential growing outside world. And to have exponential linearly increasing m, this equation says that f of a, again, has to be a constant, but a constant different from zero. So in other words, we will predict a constant activity, but shifted from its original level, A0, but yet still constant, okay? So let's look at some data. This is measured by Fred, the same technique, but you're using, instead of a step function, using a ramp. Okay, here's the ramp. You start at T0, you ramp up exponentially, and you measure the activity. If this ought to be a step function, as I said, initially we go down, but eventually we go up, back up, adapt. But this one would never adapt because the environment never becomes steady. You're chasing a moving target. So you can only do this well. So that agreed with our prediction. And also, furthermore, we predict that the amount of shift, this activity shift, depends on the ramp rate, right? And that is exactly that dependence, the shift dependent on ramp rate, will give us this function, f. Right? So in Howard's lab, Tom Schmidt, who has measured that with different ramp rate from low to high, higher and yet higher, and this is the curve he got. The shift activity versus the rate, which can translate into the function f. So this is the measurement. This is the mysterious function, this adaptation kinetic rate, f of a, by measuring the dependent response to a time-dependent signal. We're almost to the end. So what about sine waves with different frequency? OK, so we did that. Again, let's first look at the theory. You can easily do the theoretical work, linear analysis, frequency spectrum analysis. What we get is that if you give the cell a perturbation that goes with a frequency f and amplitude a of l, we can look at the response of the activity and also this internal variable a of m. Of course, this is not measurable, but this is. What we find is this function, I of f, frequency divided by IF over F of M times the amplitude of AL. At low frequency, this goes to zero. So this goes to linearly with the frequency, right? This goes to zero. This is a constant. At low frequency, A response goes as I omega, IF. Okay? Keep that in mind. At high frequency, it becomes a constant. How does it look? Again, this is experimental data. And there's two things you can measure, the response amplitude and the phase shift to the stimulus, right? The lines are a prediction from the theory. The dots are the measurements. The amplitude, as I promised you, goes down linearly at low frequency and saturate at a high frequency. The phase is very interesting, right? The phase shift is half of a pi, or half a 2 pi, so half a period, sorry, and goes up to be one period, to be basically in phase, right? Because there's a negative sign involved. So what does it tell you? Originally, when people see this, people say, aha, I know what this means. This means it is a high-pass filter. It passes here. Doesn't pass here. Wrong. Why is that? Because the phase. What this really is doing is calculate the derivative of the outside world. If you take the Fourier transfer on the derivative, what would you get? You get I omega or IF in front of the amplitude, right? So this is exactly what the cell is trying to do. It's in the low frequency region. It tries to calculate time derivative of the outside world in the low frequency region. If you divide it by I omega, you get exactly, so it passes the information of the derivative at low frequency and damp it at high frequency. The phase tells it all, actually. If you calculate the derivative, what would you get the phase shift? Pi over 2, right? Sorry, this is actually pi in unit of pi. That's exactly what happens here. At this region, it's more close to pi over 2. So the cell is actually trying to calculate derivative in a low frequency instead of passing information at higher frequency and damp the low frequency. So I don't have time to go into anything about how the cell differentiate different attractants. Whether you know you're eating vegetable and meat, or more vegetable and more meat, and so on and so forth. So you actually can distinguish that. The cell, we find that it actually have a clever algorithm to do that. We don't have that. You can ask me later. At the charts is there. Here's what we promised you in the beginning. That the chemotaxis pathway is really a molecular device to do signal processing. At some level of abstraction, you can say that. It's a little device here. It amplifies the signal in a wide range of background. How does it do that? Receptor-receptor interaction in the cluster and perfect adaptation really broadens that high gain region to a very wide range. It senses the concentration in log scale. We show that why that come about, because the energetics of the methylation, internal variable is linear, whereas the outside variable, the concentration, is log scale. And this is actually follows to a very famous law in sensory system called Weber-Fechner law in sensory system that says in a lot of the other sensory systems, same thing happen. You are sensing relative change instead of absolute value. Information compression, this is also very good for that because a wide range of concentration is compressed into a manageable number of methylation level, linear level, right? And in terms of signal along the line of signal processing, it's really a low-pass filter for the derivative of the signal, not for the signal itself. Okay? So this part of the spectrum tells you that it actually is passing the information of the derivative, the low frequency. And this part I haven't told you about is that it records information on different ligands by the methylation level of the corresponding receptor. Namely, the memory is local, although the action is global. Some remaining challenges at the molecular level, we really don't understand how the receptor actually form these clusters. We also don't understand the molecular base, even though we have measured the function f of a, methylation rate function. The next step to do is to understand molecularly how does the key R and key B interact with the receptor to give rise to this function f of a. At the behavior level, I told you that this is something we were working on, and we have some preliminary result. How does the system differentiate different signal? How does the same pathway be used to perform other tasks? So this goes back to what Will is interested in, is that the same pathway, the same chemosensing pathway, in E. coli at least, is found to enable thermotaxis. In other words, the same pathway is used to sense temperature, but in a different way. It doesn't like just higher temperature. It likes a particular temperature. But it was able to do that. Now, why such a big gain? What about noise? Right? The biological systems are built by a finite number of each type of molecule. There's a lot of molecular level noise. And there's a lot of noise due to ligand binding, due to fluctuating environment. How does the cell deal with that? How does it filter it? So we're working on all these issues. But I think we have built a solid theoretical framework to tackle these questions and to really make very intimate contact with experimental biologists to try to understand these fascinating behaviors. Thank you.